By the way, we will put, you know, the whole pile of stuff on the website and send you a link. My style of talk preparation is I write it all out, sort of thinking out loud with the keyboard, and then I say more something like that, but never quite that. So I end up with notes that are more or less like sort of an unpolished essay, and then the talk itself, which is based on that, but a little different. So you'll get a twofer if you want to go through this all again. You can read the notes or listen to the talk or watch the talk if all this works. Or maybe you'll have had enough by then. So, anyway, hi. We'll just keep doing this forever, right? I was thinking, you know, as I emerged from my little hut and so reliably saw many of you walking along so quietly and mindfully in the grass, you know. And I was realizing, I didn't really realize this before, that how supportive appreciation is of our practice. When appreciation comes up, it's so supportive of practice. I think it's not necessary that it's there, it's not always there, but when it comes up strongly, I saw somebody turning around at the end of her little walking path. I just felt, wow, look at that. And it wasn't so much that I appreciated her, although I did, but I think it was that I could really appreciate this practice a little more, which helped me out a lot, so I appreciated that a lot too. So we can enjoy when appreciation comes up, it helps keep us going. And what seems to be absent, we just keep going. Maybe it's there, but we're not noticing it at the moment. Who knows? So I've received several kind of like technical questions about the workings of the mind in our chats and in the notes department. So I thought I would dip us a little more into technical Buddhist analysis of how the functions of the mind are mapped. We can take our initial metaphor of an assembly line of consciousness to a deeper level, adding more little robotic arms that go in there and move things around and add things and take off parts and add parts, and resulting in this stream of consciousness at the end point that we consider to be just like me or reality or something like that. But I hesitate a little bit, of course. I have a little trepidation about bringing this stuff up, because it would be very easy to lose ourselves into some kind of idea that we could figure all this out, and that it's all about a sort of developing a better intellectual model of reality, and then everything will be okay. Maybe it's also a little problematic to think that there is any model of reality that is really true, is really accurate. Because really the thing that matters to us most here, I think, is just this continuous application of mindful awareness. And as we're learning, it's so helpful to take a little inner step back and just watch. Just watch. Watch with curiosity, watch with openness, watch with surprise. Whoa. Yeah. Watch without thinking too much about how you think it should go or shouldn't go or it always goes. I really appreciated Karen's little model of the oatmeal arrangement before we went over there. And, oh, that's true, you know. We do think we know what's there. And when we're so convinced we know what's there, we don't necessarily actually see what's there. So hopefully you got some real oatmeal, not imagined oatmeal, you know. I hope so. Because they're a little bit different. And the other thing about technical questions about the mind is that sometimes it may imply that somebody somewhere knows for sure how the mind works exactly. A high meditator or a brilliant neuroscientist, pick your flavor, a highly refined philosopher. And presumably, if I'm the meditation teacher here, I must have some deeper knowledge about how it all works. Well, it might be that I'm just not deep enough or clear enough yet. That could be true. Probably is true. Or it might also be that nobody for sure really knows how the mind works. I'm not so sure anyone can really give you a definitive answer to even some fairly simple sounding questions. Like, for instance, we often get the question in MBSR class, why does the mind wander so much? And our teachers say with great confidence, to help normalize the situation and give them hope, we always say something usually like, oh, it's the mind's nature to wander. As if we actually knew what the mind was. As if we actually knew that it has a nature that describes it in some kind of systematic and meaningful way. Because, of course, we don't really know. But we figured it wouldn't be that helpful to say, God, no clue. How is it for you? Oh, you want your money back? So we say, oh, that's the nature of the mind. Because it's helpful, you know. It's not true, right? It does seem to be a very frequent, so frequent as if to seem continuous state of the mind. Lots of mind wandering, random thoughts and stuff. So it's not like it's false. But is it really true? Or maybe we might invoke the great God of neuroscience and say, oh, it's the pathways in your brain. They're wired up that way. And maybe if we have some time and we're feeling a little neuroscientific chutzpah, we'll talk about the default mode network, which is really a cool neuroscience thing. There seem to more or less be a set of interconnected brain regions that are active when you're just hanging out, just spacing out. And they're distributed, I'm told, kind of along the midline area of the brain, kind of front to back, a little set of them hooked together. And these connected brain areas seem to be associated with mind wandering, daydreaming, and what they so eloquently call self-referential processing. Not a great term. In other words, there seem to be a set of brain regions that the scientific community decided to call the default mode network. Remember, that's a decision, right? It does not come with a label, you know? So, and then we say it is called the default mode network, as if that was true. There seem to be this set of brain regions that we call that. That's all about me, 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 me. How am I doing right now? Did I remember everything I was supposed to do? Do I look okay? How should I answer that question? Do we have enough groceries for dinner? And so on and so forth. And the super cool and exciting thing is that some initial studies show that experienced meditators, or I should say seem to show that experienced meditators, when they're hanging out, show less activity in these regions, this default mode network. So maybe the me, 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 blah, blah, blah does get quieter over time through practice. And it's funny, I'm extra convinced about this science because I know a few of the scientists, you know, personally. So it must be true, they're my friends. Yeah. And personally, it's really hard for me to say if that's so in my experience. Because when I'm wondering about that, when I'm wondering about whether there's less mind wandering in my own head, in that moment I'm really kind of existing in the same realm of me, me, me. Me, 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 trying to remember whether I, before, had more mind wandering than I have now in this me, me, me space, you know? And I think I can't really say. Like, I can't really remember, you know? And I'm not even sure if it was me before, anyway. I definitely want to think it's true, and I actually do believe that it's true, so, you know, full disclosure, I believe that. Me, me, me believes that. And I have had a few moments where it does seem like the evidence is there, that there has been some kind of qualitative change in the way the mind works. It's about to say my mind works, but that seems a little suspect too. Is it really my mind? Like one time, I went to a little conference about mindfulness in Seattle. And there was a prominent mindfulness and psychology guy there named Ron Siegel. And if you live in the Seattle area, you can go to these. They do them once or twice a year. There's an organization called FACES. It's an acronym of some kind, F-A-C-E-S. So it puts them on. And they're okay. They're pretty good. Anyway, Ron Siegel's talking about habitual patterns of the mind. And he makes part of his point, makes a point about how inevitable these patterns seem to be. And he does this by putting up a slide that just has one word on it. Big slide with one word in black and white. I can't remember what the word was. I don't think it really mattered what the word was. But what he's saying with great confidence is your mind cannot help but see this shape, this image, as a word, and only a word. And then your mind instantly will make all these associations from the word's meaning. So I was curious about this. So I kind of like softened my gaze and kind of invited something that I think of as practicing. I don't know what, you know, breath and body or settling or getting out of my head. I don't know what. And I found I was quite able to see that image before me as shapes and pattern. A black and white. I guess there's still an idea of black and white there. Mostly curvy shapes, some straight shapes. And I don't know how stable that is, and it's not like I didn't know that was a word that I was looking at, but I found it quite possible to experience it as non-word. I chose not to raise my hand and argue with Ron Siegel, prominent expert. You know how egotistical that would be. I did kind of wonder if other people in the audience were having the same thought. I don't know. But it was interesting to see that the mind with practice probably has more variability than some of the so-called experts running around giving the lectures are saying. So maybe that's evidence that the brain has rewired or consciousness has changed. And if the brain has rewired itself, then it must be consciousness emerges from this rewired brain in a different shape or form or has different processes to it than were accessible before. I don't really know. Our fascination with the brain is pretty interesting. And it's cool, too. But again, do we really know what we think we know? I once saw a YouTube lecture by a neuroscientist meditation person named Willoughby Britton, who's at Brown University. She's part of a kind of a cohort, they're probably all in their mid-40s now, of young neuroscientists who came up during the emergence of mindfulness and meditation and practice themselves and also study it. So there's kind of a cool gang of them. They're all having a meeting in November in Phoenix. I'm going to go hang out with them. Anyway, she's part of that group. And she said she did a little informal study about the persuasiveness of the image of the brain. She gave the same talk, more or less the same talk, several times. I don't know how many times. She wasn't claiming this to be authoritative, but she gave the same talk several times to different audiences. And half of the time in her slides, she had an image of the brain. And half of the time she didn't. And she had feedback forms or something. I don't know how she collected her data. But what she claimed was, the times when she showed the image of the brain, even though she said more or less the same words, people found her talks much more informative and much more authoritative. Found her to be, you know, a better scientist. So anyway. So there's a real power to the god of neuroscience, you know. I mean, the brain certainly seems very clearly to be involved in the mind. And there do seem to be strong associations between activation in areas of the mind, or I guess it's more accurate if I understand it, saying networks of areas in the mind, and things that happen in our mind. But it's probably not true to say the mind comes straight from the brain. There's plenty of evidence that doesn't hold up. So anyway, this was all about mapping the mind and understanding the mind. And I'm trying to say all this not to like discourage you, we're never going to figure this out, but encourage you, because we're never going to figure this out. That I think it's really good for us to have a healthy sense of not knowing. Because there's a sort of endless treadmill of stress and suffering to believing that our liberation is only through our knowing. We definitely need knowing. Knowing is our friend. But knowing is not the boss of the world. We also need our other friend, I think, not knowing. So neuroscience, and you know, neuroscience people will admit this very freely. I heard one of them saying, it's kind of like our vision of how the mind works is like when I was flying out in the airplane to get here. You know, it was a meeting in Boston and he flew across the Midwest or something like that. I'm looking down at the farm fields of Iowa and I'm wondering how individual plants work, you know. But all I can see is this image from 30,000 feet of the farm fields. You know, it's kind of like that, I guess. It's a little rough. You know, probably that's a corn growing region, you know. Okay. But do we really know how it all works? And the same with early Buddhism. I love early Buddhism and I love later Buddhism, and they're fantastic models of how consciousness works. I find them very helpful. But there's also something a little too tidy about them, actually. It seems to me in our experience that reality is infinitely varied, complex, and subtle. So how can any one model really accurately capture it? Can we really justify the language that's used when we're talking about these models and we say it is this way and it is that way? If we just cross out all the is-is and say could be, or often is, or sometimes is, or tends to be in some situations. And it's also helpful, I think, to recognize that we all already have a model of consciousness that we've all built up over the years. My teacher used to say, everyone's a philosopher. Each of us has our own philosophy of how things go and how things are, which we use to predict what's coming next. But the problem with our inner mind science is that we have a very powerful version of what they call confirmation bias in the sciences, which is just what it sounds like if you don't hang out with science people. We tend to find ways to confirm our assumptions, right? And ignore contrary evidence. And it's hard to talk about this because we're in the middle of that model right now. But again, it's one of the great aspects of retreat, is that sometimes we find little contradictions to our model. And one of the benefits of our hours and hours and hours of practice is it tends, on the whole, usually, to lend us a little more stability of mind, a little more openness of mind, a little more possible to say, oh wow, I'm wrong about that. Holy smokes. You know? Always thought it was this way, now I see it was that way. Wow. So it's good to stay curious. It's the good dollop of not knowing. There's a famous story in the Zen tradition of which the punchline is, not knowing is most intimate. Not knowing is most intimate. So just feel into that for a moment, if you would. How does that feel to you, having sat here for all these days? Not knowing is most intimate. This isn't a figure it out kind of phrase. It's a feeling to it. So anyway, this was like a little preamble, you know, trying to reduce the damage of telling you about all these models. They're helpful, but are they really correct and real in that kind of way that our mind wants? The knowing half of the equation, that mind. So yeah, the early Buddhists came up with a very fine model of how this assembly line puts itself together, with different merging assembly lines and branches and connections, and these things tend to pull forward those things. And it really takes into account the first foundation of the body and the physicality of existence and our experience of that, and the second foundation of how things get flavored and the tendencies they have, the sort of tone they have, the valence they have. And this third foundation, the complex ways that the thinking mind processes and adds stuff. But wait, you might say, what about this rumored fourth foundation? What about that? So I thought I'd better say a few words about that before I dive into this model. Lest there be a lot of grasping in your mind, you know? So the fourth foundation is kind of hard to talk about briefly is the problem, so I'll attempt it. I'm not winning any award for brevity in any of these talks. So on the one hand, the fourth foundation of mindfulness is awareness of the deep patterns of mind, or the deep patterns of experience or reality, which is more or less the same thing. The fourth foundation at this level is kind of like the stuff, the universe, that the third foundation, the mind, is interacting with. And the second foundation is coloring, and the first foundation is like providing the host for, or the embodiment of, or the container to allow it all to happen, you know, in a way that we can experience. So that works fine, and that's fairly useful and common sense. We can think about the fourth foundation of mindfulness as mental patterns, habit patterns. If the third foundation is like moments of mind, here's a moment of anger, a moment of sleepiness, a moment of memory, a moment of this or that that we can label in the labeling practice. I hope you've been trying that. Great practice. It takes a little persistence, though. So anyway, if the third foundation is these mind moments, then maybe we could think about the fourth foundation about being about how they coalesce in this way and that way. Some coalescing patterns really help us, and some cause all kinds of problems. So no one of these foundations is inherently good or bad, you know. They're just descriptions of how it is. So that would be a useful way to think about the fourth foundation. You're really curious about patterns of mind. We talk in the mindfulness world a lot about autopilot, right? That's kind of a powerful pattern of mind, you know. The pattern takes over and runs us for a while until we come back again, you know. Whoa, how'd I get here? We very much love in the mindfulness class talking about the autopilot of driving. And that is amazing to me every time I think about that. I haven't had this. Have you had this experience? I haven't had this in a little while that I have noticed. Maybe I've had it without noticing, but well, you can pull into your driveway at home if you are a car driver, and not, if you're really honest, not really remember how you got there. You know? That's amazing. You know? So patterns of mind are taking care of you, you know. And of course, your very self is a deep pattern of mind. Maybe our deepest pattern of mind. So that's useful. But it may be incomplete. There's also a deeper way of looking at the fourth foundation of mindfulness. It's kind of like the nature of reality. So now this is going to sound a little far out. We could also think about the fourth foundation of mindfulness as a deep invitation to notice something really important about how we function. To study how compelling objects of mind are. Because that's what we focus on, right? We focus on objects of mind. And here, even the so-called physical objects are actually seen as something that are mirrored in the mind as mind objects. So we're not really seeing a tree, in other words. We're seeing a conceptualization of a tree inspired by an image of a tree, and there's like 17 more steps in there, you know. So it's a mind object. I see a tree, we say. Or I see a grouchy thought, you know. Or more likely, she's obnoxious, which is a manifestation of this, a mind object. So the study of the fourth foundation suggests that's not all there is. It's making a practice suggestion that we soften our focus, like it's so narrowly on this object, then that object, then that object. And notice, like, when the objects arise and pass away, that's kind of a bridge to that, and the Buddha mentioned that in the text. We notice the objects rising and passing away, that's kind of a step. Oh, okay. It's not just objects, they come and they go. But where do they come and they go from? So that's another way of glossing the fourth foundation of mindfulness. The space, you could say. The stuff that this sort of emerges from, or something like that. It's hard to talk about this. So it's a softening or a shifting or an opening of our gaze or a curiosity about what's just out of sight in our peripheral vision of our mind. We move our attention from what they call form to what they call formlessness. Form here is all the stuff. Includes the mental stuff of life. Everything we can conceptualize is form. Everything that has characteristics and qualities is form. Everything we can manipulate, think about, wonder about, describe is form. And sometimes we lose track of there being anything other than form, is the implied teaching of the fourth foundation. In the fourth foundation, some would say, the Buddha is basically saying, like an infomercial, maybe I'm dating myself, he's kind of saying, and wait, there's more, right? And the more is non-form, the formless. So in case it's helpful, we could dip back into physics and think about astronomy for a minute. Maybe this idea of non-form or the formless is like dark matter, like the dark matter of our lives. Something that must be there to balance things out. In astrophysics, as I understand it, it's a very limited understanding, dark matter is the matter that simply must be there to explain the way things are. To explain the shape and gravitational characteristics of the universe. But there just isn't enough detectable matter to make sense of the way the universe is. So there must be dark matter. And in some celestial areas, it seems that there must be more than in other areas, because there's varying amounts of detectable matter, which further suggests the existence of dark matter. If there can be more of it and less of it, then it has more of a sense of matter, but does it actually make sense to call something that we can't detect matter? Is another question, I don't know. So before I get in trouble, I'll move off of that. But I don't want to create too many notes. So maybe there's the same kind of deeper quality to our lives that the fourth foundation is sort of pointing to. A little like the image of the finger pointing to the moon, you know? A kind of substrate of our lives, a kind of feeling for our lives that's beyond our knowing, beyond what we think about. A sense of backstory or space. Sometimes it gets called emptiness, sometimes space. And we talk about feeling the space, and that does have meaning to us, I guess, right? We say that as if it means something. So there's some kind of feeling to spaciousness, but it's hard to describe. Maybe if it really is spaciousness, it's literally impossible to describe, because that would require language, and this is something that is beyond language, concept, or that kind of knowing. Like the mystery side of things, if you will. Not knowing is most intimate. So another way of thinking about this level or layer or way of thinking about the fourth foundation is, or way of practicing with it actually, is just curiosity. Just mere curiosity about the space in which it's all unfolding, this thing you call your life. So you can't really direct yourselves towards it or figure it out or look for it. But there's a sense to it, you know what I mean? I don't really know how to say it other than that. Sometimes you know you're in contact with it because of the qualities that it seems to be associated with, the sense of spaciousness, flexibility, curiosity. Maybe there's a little less chattering of the mind, I don't know. A kind of stability and even a kind of joyousness that's just very quiet, quiet kind of joyousness. Maybe the most central characteristic of the formless, whatever this is trust. You just trust life more, it seems, when you're in a fuller relationship with formlessness, with space, with emptiness, with everything else. Maybe this is some of what they mean by God, I don't really know. Although it's really weird of me to say that its central characteristic in trust, when I just said a few minutes ago, this is about reality beyond characteristics. But you gotta say something. That's the problem. Which brings us right back to my little, you know, warm-up story. Was that yesterday? About the great Zen masters coming in and sitting down and not saying a word during the lecture time. That's why. That's why. The more you say, the more confusion you create. So mostly I just want to invite a lot of curiosity, like a lot, you know? What is it, this life? To ask that question without really expecting an answer in words or language or images. Sometimes there is kind of a little rush of intimacy with whatever you want to call it. Floods in us, there's a moment that we feel very something, open, peaceful, expansive, I don't know. People describe these kind of things all different ways, and there's no way of knowing if it's the same thing they're describing. And it would be easy for the mind that thinks and grasps to get very excited about that idea. Oh, that sounds cool. How do you get that? I think more often it's like the dawn, especially the dawn in the northern latitudes. Dawn at the equator comes up pretty quick, actually, but our dawn comes up slowly, especially this time of year. It's really hard to tell the moment when you see the first light of the day, isn't it? You're like, it's night, it's definitely night. Oh, dawn has started. When did it start? Maybe it's like that. You don't really notice it, and then there it is. Is there a moment when it wasn't light and a moment when it was light? Hard to know. So this all sounds very exotic and far out, but it's really not. It's ordinary. It's the simplest thing in the world. It's just hard to put into language. And it's something you already know. You already experience. It's the quality of our feeling for life. But just maybe sometimes we're a little more in touch with it than others. You know what I mean? People have all different ways about talking about this. So I'll just park the fourth foundation there. I don't want to bring up both of these kind of aspects of it, because different teachers, scholars, authors emphasize different things about the fourth foundation. The Buddha leaves it a little bit ambiguous, and we'll look tomorrow at how he describes it. We can think about the fourth foundation as both deep patterns of mind, and maybe the deepest pattern of all, which is no pattern, non-pattern. But not to worry about it too much. Probably the best thing is just to stay steady in practice. And just be curious about these deeper feelings, deeper patterns, as they seem to manifest or not. And if you feel like, wow, fourth foundation. That's a little bit like when I was almost done with the talk, or preparing, I thought, oh good, I have a little time, I'll go get a cup of coffee and come back and take one more look at this. And as I got up to get the cup of coffee, I pictured the kitchen. And I pictured our dear cooks, Pam and Penny and Mark, who's there just a few hours. I felt this huge wave of gratitude, and love, and space, a joyous kind of spacious feeling. Oh, wow. And I was walking in the kitchen, I kind of looked a little bit as I was going to the coffee maker and kind of saw that they were there. And I kind of started to think about, should I go in and say thank you? And I started to imagine dialogues in my head of the best way to say thank you. On my behalf and your behalf, how incredibly grateful we are, and how much we love them, or how much I love them, or something. And then walking back, still debating about what to do about this feeling, I looked in there and I saw just how peaceful they were, how focused on their tasks, how quiet actually, doing deep meditation practice of their own. And I realized that hollering out, thank you so much, would just be disruptive, actually. Would not be actually an expression of gratitude, but just kind of poking a stick in something, So I just smiled, to myself. So maybe it's like that when you feel the fourth foundation. You don't need to holler, You just appreciate. Then the next moment, something else happens, So anyway, that's like a talk-length introduction to what I wanted to talk about. Sorry. So we won't finish this whole article on the inner workings of the third foundation, but we'll start it and then we'll finish it tomorrow. And remember, it'll be in the notes. You can read this later if you learn much better by reading. By reading stuff, you can do that later. For now, the intention is not so much to learn this stuff, but just to stay in your practice, Listening to the talk is the same as listening to the wind, Equally important, or not. So this is an article by someone named Andrew Olensky. He's a contemporary American Buddhist scholar and teacher. I think he's a sort of independent Buddhist scholar, not an academic. But he's a big fan of this early Buddhist model of mind. That's all he talks about. I've not met him, but I've read many things by him, and this is a particularly well-done article because the map itself is outrageously complicated. 7 long volumes, And sometimes you talk about it so simply, it's hard to really get much from it. And other times you talk about it too complexly, and you'd have to spend a few years in the seminar to understand it. It doesn't do any good. So this particular article, I think you just walked that line very nicely, at least to my mind, it did. Gives you some of the complexity, and enough to kind of sink your teeth into. Probably still confusing. So I'll read it, and I'll occasionally break in with a few comments where I think it actually helps try to be restrained. So this is Andrew. The English language is rich in many ways, particularly when explaining the features of the material world, but is remarkably clumsy when it comes to articulating the nuanced terrain of inner experience. This is one of the reasons the current conversations about consciousness, meditation, and psychology in general can be somewhat confusing. One of the satisfactions of studying the languages and literatures of India is the exposure it offers to a richer and more precise vocabulary for speaking about inner states of mind. At the time, Greek philosophers were seeking to identify the universal substrates out of which all matter is constructed. Their counterparts in India were exploring empirically and directly the textures of consciousness. By the time Socrates suggested that care of the soul was an appropriate thing for philosophers to attend to, a detailed and highly developed map of the mind and body as a system of lived experience had been delineated by the Buddha and his immediate followers. You already see this as a fundamentalist tradition. I mean, fundamentalist in a good way. You know? The Buddha and his immediate followers, they got it. Part of the literature containing this lore is called the Abhidhamma. It is an attempt to extract some of the Buddha's core teachings about the phenomenology of experience from the narrative context of the Dhamma, the teachings, and organize it in a systematic and consistent presentation. I'd like to offer a taste of this greater precision by considering the question, what is mindfulness? As the term grows in importance in contemporary discourse, its meaning seems to be becoming less rather than more clear. Fortunately, the rich vocabulary and meditative insight of the Abhidhamma teachings can help us understand better what the word mindfulness is referring to. In the process, this excursion will also include some general observations about how the mind functions and how these functions are augmented by the deliberate power of meditation. Moreover, it will touch on the relationship between the cultivation of mindfulness and the emergence of wisdom. So how does your mind respond to that little promise? You get excited? Or depending on your conditioning, bored, or, oh God, you know, how long is this going to be, or something. But it's a pretty strong assertion right away. Here's the map. Yeah. Okay, so we'll do a few more paragraphs. According to the Abhidhamma, consciousness arises and passes away each moment as a series of episodes in a continuing process. It is not a thing that exists, but an event that occurs again and again. And this yields the subjective experience of a stream of consciousness. Consciousness itself is rather simple and austere, consisting merely of the cognizing of a sense object by means of a sense organ. That's consciousness. And this event serves as a sort of seed around which a number of other mental factors crystallize to help consciousness create meaning from the stimuli presenting themselves so rapidly and relentlessly at the doors of the senses. And remember, in this model, the thinking mind is one of those senses. Like a king with his entourage, as the classical image has it, consciousness never arises alone. It's always attended by a number of other mental factors. Those are like the courtesans, the other mental factors that help structure, shape, and direct rudimentary consciousness in various ways. The idiosyncrasies of our experience come from the unique configurations formed by all these supporting mental factors as they interact each moment with the changing data of the senses and the synthetic instructions of the mind. Altogether, 52 of these mental factors were enumerated in the Pali Abhidhamma. The Sanskrit Abhidharma transition is a somewhat different list. Let's not get into that, he says in parentheses. Scholars have tended to dismiss this exhaustive catalog of mental states as the product of scholasticism run amok. So I feel like he's talking to me. Sorry. Try to listen. But many people with a mature practice of Vipassana meditation are thrilled by the precision with which this literature describes the interior landscape. It is the child of two parents. Its mother is deep empirical observation of meditative experience, while its father is a brilliant organizing intellect. As I review the Abhidhamma perspective on meditation and mindfulness, I will identify each mental factor by its Pali term and its number on the list for the sake of clarity. So doesn't this like appeal to your, yes, there's a list. Numbers, everything. It's great. So I identify each mental factor by its Pali term and its number on the list for the sake of clarity, but I will not consider all the mental factors nor treat them in their strict canonical order. So that's the genius of this article. I don't mean to give him a hard time. It's really brilliant the way he does this. But there is a certain enthusiasm that you may have noticed, Everyone thinks their thing is right. That's what it comes down to. Isn't that great? So let's just do the first two steps and that'll be enough for today. More than enough. Okay. The first section he calls universal mental factors. Universal mental factors. Meditation starts with getting in touch with experience at the point of its inception. We literally make contact. Paso. Factor number one. We make contact. Number one is contact. We literally make contact with what's happening in the present moment. If we are daydreaming or worrying or wondering what to do next, we let go of that for the moment and get grounded at one of the sense doors. What is the actual physical sensation arising from this moment at the body door as I begin to draw an in-breath? That's a moment of contact. Can I get right to the cutting edge of the sound produced by that chirping bird outside the window? Contact. Dropping down from the level of thinking about something to getting in touch with what is actually occurring right now is referred to as making contact with the sensation just as it first arrives at one of the sense doors. So that's number one, contact. We immediately notice that this sensation is always accompanied by a feeling tone. Vedana, number two, so we know about that. This feeling tone can be grossly or subtly pleasant or unpleasant. This is a strand of experience that brings with it a sense of embodiment and awareness of visceral sensitivity. Every sensation comes with its own distinct quality, with a sense of what it feels like to be having this experience right here and now. Even when it is not obviously pleasant or unpleasant, there is nevertheless an affective tone that strings our moments of experience into a continuous flow of feeling, which, like the cognitive flow of the stream of consciousness, contributes to the feeling of being a living organism. Meditation can focus on discerning the distinction between bare sensory contact and the feeling tone that colors the sensation. I was saying flavors, he says colors. The stimulus is one thing, while the feeling tone that gives it depth and flavor, he said it too, depth and flavor is another. Okay, we have time for one more. We'll do number three. So second was Vedana, feeling tone. The first was contact. So it's, yeah, it's very similar to what I was saying, right? It's just going to get more far out tomorrow. Perception, sanya, perception, number three, is another mental factor occurring with every moment of consciousness. So this stuff's always happening. This first section is the stuff that's always happening. Perception's function is to interpret what it is that we are seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, or thinking in any particular episode of cognition. Perception puts together knowledge about the presenting object based upon a wide network of associations, memories, analyses, learned perceptual categories, and linguistic labels. These manifest as representations, symbols, words, icons, or other images we might form to interpret the sense data into meaningful categories of thought. This happens automatically and subliminally in every moment. But meditation can bring a heightened attentiveness to this process. So we become more consciously aware of our perceptions, and the perceptions themselves can become more acute. More acute. So this is maybe what the Buddha was talking about in the little preamble about clarity, right? Become more acute, more clear on our perception. So this is all before we've really thought about it. There's contact, there's feeling tone to it, and there's a perception. And somehow in the system, they have to solve a problem, too, which he is saying they mostly solve so far with the second step, with feeling tone, with Vedana. The problem is, on the one hand, it's just individual moments of the mind coming together, of consciousness being formed, right? And that we have this sense of continuity, right? It seems to be me going along, you know? And they're saying, well, it's not you going along, it's these separate moments. So something's spilling over, you know, something's linking one moment to the next. He says there's something about feeling and something about cognition, which we'll get into more later. So, I want to end with a poem. Just take me a little moment to find it. And this is like to be continued, you know? Yeah, but not to bang on this drum too hard, another way to look at all this stuff is the difference between the map and the actual territory. It's good to have the best map we can find, right? Trying to find our way around here, you know? We realize we're a little lost in our life. And our current map, which we didn't even realize we had, but we've been staring at it this whole time, seemed to be a little off. So here's a more refined map. But it's not the same as your actual life, right? Your actual mind, your actual experience. But knowledge helps us see more clearly, right? You know, you, like nature is a great example. I love nature and I took a degree in it. You know, when you know more about nature, you just somehow see more, right? I know pretty much all the native plants growing in this property, and so when I see them, somehow I see them, I don't know, maybe a little more clearly, I don't know. It's hard, I can't unknow their names anymore, you know. So maybe the maps help us see things more clearly. But then, they're also a problem. Because if I just say, Rubus ursinus, the native blackberry, I'm not really looking at the plant anymore, you know. I'm just looking at a name or a label. So there's downsides to maps too, of course. Short little fragment from Rumi to close today. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there's a field I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, and even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense anymore. Out beyond ideas of right doing and wrongdoing, there's a field. I'll meet you there. So maybe we can extend that. Out beyond ideas of how my mind works and doesn't work, there's a field. I'll meet you there. We've been there all along, you know. That's where we're hanging out. So thank you for hanging out here so devotedly in this field beyond knowing and not knowing, understanding and not understanding. I think it's a useful field to hang out in, even if we don't really know what's going on. All right.